to take the uncertainty out of every bite, people tend to develop a reductionist belief that food is either good or bad. Rosen says this type of belief establishes a goal, which is both extremely unhealthy and unattainable. What about nutrition by the numbers? New York Times columnist Michael Pollan profoundly struck a chord with the simplicity of his advice in his best-selling book, In Defense of Food, An Eater's Manifesto, published in 2008. He explored a very complex topic of nutrition science, politics, and the industrialization of food, yet managed to describe how to eat healthfully in just 7 words. Eat food, not too much, mostly plants. There are no numbers to strive for, no grams, calories, or any nutrient quotas. Consider that for nearly 2 decades there has been nutrition information on just about every food label, thanks to the 1990 Nutrition Labeling and Education Act. Yet the incidence of obesity and eating disorders in the United States has steadily risen ever since. There's even more nutrition information available today, thanks to the Internet. Pollan popularized the term nutritionism, a paradigm created by Dr. Gyorgy Skrinis, which describes how the overly reductive focus on nutrients in food undermines how we think about food, how we view the experiences of our own bodies, and how we understand the relationship between food and our bodies. Ultimately, the nutritionism ideology has only served to add a lot of anxiety to grocery shopping and food selection. We agree. Our experience has shown that the more a person focuses on a number, the more it interferes with the process of listening to the body. Eating healthfully should feel good, both physically and psychologically, ultimately resulting in a satisfying experience. But we've lost sight of that feeling due to the food and fat phobia that's sweeping the country. Michelle Stacy, author of Consumed, Why Americans Love, Hate, and Fear Food, concludes that Americans need to change their eating attitude to enlightened hedonism, a balance between information and pleasure, an educated hedging of bets. That's how we approach nutrition and food. We amend Pollan's recommendation to do the following. Enjoy eating food, not too much, not too little, mostly what satisfies you. Making peace with nutrition, achieving authentic health. Critics express concern that encouraging people to eat what they want will lead them to eat with abandon, resulting in poor nutrition and weight gain. The underlying belief is that self-monitoring is essential for keeping appetite under control. It is thought that without this vigilance, people would make nutritionally poor choices, including eating to excess. Yet several studies show that eating restraint is associated with weight gain. Instead, intuitive eating is associated with improved nutrient intake, eating a wider variety of food, reduced eating disorder symptomatology, and lower body mass. For more details, see The Science Behind Intuitive Eating, Chapter 17. Eating healthfully feels good. When you remove the clutter of guilt and morality from eating, it allows you to really feel the physical sensations that you derive from eating. Many of our clients unknowingly create a somatization of guilt from their eating experience. This occurs when the feelings of guilt arise in tandem with the unpleasant physical sensations of eating without attunement. It becomes an intertwined union of uncomfortable feelings from guilt and the discomfort from eating, joined into one physical experience. When you know you can truly eat whatever food or meals you want, without guilt, why would you choose to feel physically uncomfortable? Here is one of my favorite stories that illustrates how eating healthfully simply feels good. My son was in his rebellious teenage phase and had spent an entire day at an amusement park. When he came home, he rushed into the kitchen and said, "Mom, I ate junky today. Will you make me something extra healthy for dinner? This was not a boy trying to please his mom or score points, nor was he uber health conscious. He just knew how it feels to eat healthy and was seeking that experience for his next meal. What is healthy eating? We define healthy eating as having a healthy balance of foods and having a healthy relationship with food. Of course, there is a nutritional difference between eating an apple versus a piece of apple pie. Having a healthy relationship with food means you are not morally superior or inferior based on your eating choices. Eating selection is not a reflection of your character. Throughout this book, we focused on the healthy relationship part because there's been a big whopping gap in American eating that leaves out this important concern. Intuitive eating is a dynamic attunement process of your mind, body, and food. The majority of intuitive eating principles, 1 through 8, deal with attunement to your inner world, which is informed by the inner workings of your mind and body. The inner world includes your thoughts, feelings, beliefs, and physical sensations arising from within your body, such as hunger and satiety cues. Achieving authentic health is a process of dynamic integration of your inner world and the external world of health guidelines, which include exercise and nutrition. You decide if and what of the external world you'd like to integrate, ultimately to achieve authentic health. The external world includes health policy, usually a consensus from experts based on a body of research. The external world can also include philosophical preferences, such as a desire to eat locally grown foods with a low carbon footprint. If you are truly inner attuned, you can integrate this value while paying attention to hunger, fullness, satisfaction, and so forth. If, however, you enter this realm too soon, there is a risk for the new mindset to be embraced as another rigid set of rules. Food wisdom tenets. No doubt you've heard for years of the nutritional merits of variety, moderation, and balance. There's a reason these nutrition mantras have been chanted for decades. They work. It's one of the best ways to hedge your bets for healthy eating. But eat a variety of foods sounds like wear a sensible pair of shoes. Practical but easily ignored advice. A study looking at diet diversity has gotten those sensible shoes tap dancing in the spotlight of health. According to this study, reported in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, people who omitted several food groups had a higher chance of dying. Adults who ate foods from 2 or fewer food groups were associated with an excess mortality risk of 50% in men and 40% in women. But how often do you eat the same meal day after day? When's the last time you tried a new cereal or changed the kind of bread you eat? In the world of dieting, it may seem easier and safer just to eliminate foods rather than to balance them into your meals. Or perhaps you've been so afraid that you couldn't eat just moderate amounts of some foods that you just shun them altogether. But where has that gotten you? Here's where the nutritional tenets of moderation and balance can help you. First of all, moderation does not mean elimination. If you eliminate whole groups of foods, it can be harder to get the nutrients your body needs. Moderation is simply eating various amounts of food without going to extremes of either too little or too much. Secondly, balance is intended to be achieved over a period of time. It does not have to be at each and every meal. Your body does not punch a time clock. Most nutrition recommendations are intended to be an average over time, not for a single meal or a single day, and with good reason. You will not suddenly get a nutrient deficiency if you did not eat enough in one day. Similarly, you will not make or break your health from one meal or even one day of eating. It is consistency over time that matters, Our bodies are remarkably adaptable. Here are a few examples. If you eat too little iron, the body starts to absorb more of it. If you take in too much vitamin C, the body begins to excrete more of it. If you eat too little, the body slows its need for calories. We'd like to suggest another tenet: progress, not perfection. You don't have to eat perfectly to be healthy. Much of what you eat is primarily for your nutritional health, and a smaller amount is simply for pleasure. Regardless of your food choice, however, all foods can offer satisfaction. In matters of nutrition, consider taste, quantity, and quality. Taste. Eating nutritiously does not have to be about deprivation, although that's what many Americans fear. The problem is that healthy eating, for many people, has been clouded with regrettable food experiences. How often have you heard, for example, "You'll get used to it," which really means that the food tastes so bad you have to condition yourself to like it? Or how many times were you told as a child, "Eat your vegetables, then you can have dessert," which really means that vegetables are so difficult to eat that you deserve a reward for choking them down? Or maybe you've experienced inferior new healthy foods from food companies scrambling to capitalize on the latest nutrition trend, from fat-free to gluten-free. The introduction of rubbery, fat-free mozzarella to cream cheese that resembles a caulking agent hardly fosters enthusiasm for healthy eating. Pretending. This is where you close your eyes and taste buds and pretend that what you are eating is a terrific substitute for what you'd really like to be eating. For example, whipping a few ice cubes in a blender with a diet hot chocolate mix and calling it a milkshake. Hardly. Or adorning applesauce with graham cracker crumbs and pretending it's apple pie. James Beard is probably rolling in his grave. The combination of taste atrocities in the name of healthy eating with the emerging fear of food in the U.S. prompted Julia Child to take action in the late 1980s. She spearheaded a revolutionary project through the American Institute of Wine and Food, AIWF, called Resetting the American Table, Creating a New Alliance of Taste and Health. This venture joined together opinion leaders from both the culinary, taste, world, and the health community, with a mission to move Americans toward healthier eating without having to give up the pleasures of the table. Early in my career, I was fortunate to be included in this task force, which had a big influence on how I work. Julia's task force had two key conclusions. Negative, restrictive approaches to eating do not work. People need to be steered toward a healthy diet they can live with without guilt. Ultimately, the key message from the task force was, in matters of taste, consider nutrition. And in matters of nutrition, consider taste. If a food aficionado can consider nutrition without compromising his or her gastronomic palate, so can you. We call this approach gentle nutrition. Taste is important, but health is still honored, without guilt. Quantity issues. Not too much, not too little. Portion control is not an issue for intuitive eaters. Many public health policymakers attribute the inflated size of food portions to be a key contributor to obesity. But if people were truly attuned to hunger, fullness, and satisfaction, it wouldn't matter if they were served a 20-pound steak or a gallon of ice cream. That's because intuitive eaters would stop eating when comfortably satisfied. There would just be a lot more leftovers. Researcher Brian Wansink makes a strong case, with cleverly designed studies, that eating while you are distracted, also known as mindless eating, increases the quantity of food eaten. So, if you are inclined to eat with distraction, such as watching television, reading, texting, or surfing the net, you will be more likely to overeat. Eating without distraction is especially important for emerging intuitive eaters. But, of course, it doesn't need to be done perfectly. Only you can determine where you are in this process. Eat enough, not too little. Clearly, you need to eat. Remember that to stoke your metabolic fire, you need wood, not just kindling. For many of our clients, this means eating more of some foods than they are used to, especially carbohydrates. You may be thinking, forget eating more, I'll just exercise. But as we explained in Chapter 13, exercise will not prevent metabolic damage from undereating, even for athletes. Scientists at the University of British Columbia in Canada studied 14 competitive female rowers. Half of them were weight cyclers. During this study, the weight cyclers lost about 10 to 11 pounds during the 4 weeks leading up to their national championships. Consequently, their metabolic rates plummeted by about 7%. They also lost over 6 pounds of fat-free body mass, primarily muscle. In this particular study, the rowers were fortunate and were able to get back their previous metabolic rate when they began eating more. If athletes can lose precious muscle from under-eating, why would you be any different? Remember, the more muscle you have, the higher your metabolic rate. It is one reason that men need more calories than women. They naturally have more muscle. How do you make peace with feeding your body? This is a scary prospect for most of our clients. To help you overcome this fear, keep reminding yourself that by feeding your body, you are feeding your metabolism. Quality issues. Some people are eager to hear what the nutrition community is recommending in the realm of food to promote optimal health. Take out of the following sections what suits you, and be sure to let go of any guilt feelings that might emerge if you find that this information triggers any discomfort. Remember, we are not pulling the rug out from under you and suddenly telling you what we think you should eat. We are simply providing information for those who would like to learn more about nutrition. Eat enough fruits and vegetables. 3 years after Michael Pollan's book was published, the USDA revamped the iconic food pyramid and replaced it with a new concept called My Plate. One of its 6 key messages seems to reflect Pollan's plant-based advice. Make half of your plate fruits and vegetables. People who eat higher amounts of fruits and vegetables have lower risks of many chronic diseases, especially cancer. In almost every study looking at plant food and people, over 200 studies to date, plant food is associated with lowering the risk of cancer. These foods are loaded with antioxidants and fiber, which offer many other health benefits. There is a growing body of research that shows fruits and vegetables have special food factors called phytochemicals that have added health benefits. Phytochemical, limonene, plant food, citrus fruits. Potential benefit, helps increase enzymes that get rid of cancer-causing agents. Phytochemical, sulforaphania, plant food, cruciferous vegetables, broccoli, cauliflower, Brussels sprouts, and cabbage. Potential benefit, helps amplify the body's own defense against chemicals that can lead to cancer. Phytochemical, allyl sulfides, plant food, leeks, garlic, onion, chives. Potential benefit, increases the production of enzymes that make it easier for the body to excrete cancer-causing compounds. Phytochemical, ellagic acid, plant food, grapes. Potential benefit, scavenges carcinogens and may prevent them from altering the body's DNA. There are hundreds and maybe even thousands of phytochemicals. Research is just scratching the surface on their health benefits. This is one reason why we can't rely on getting all of our nutrition in a bottle. You can't manufacture compounds that have yet to be identified and put them into a supplement. One problem we've seen with our chronic dieters is that they've been veggied out. For example, nearly every diet regimen prescribes celery and carrot sticks as the safe and approved snack of choice. If that's your case, ask yourself how you can incorporate vegetables and fruit in a manner that's pleasing and does not smack of a weight loss diet, such as adding grated carrots to a favorite pasta sauce. Think of possible ways in which you can eat fruits and vegetables as a built-in component to a meal, such as vegetable lasagna, ratatouille, potato cake spiced with various chopped vegetables, stir-fried vegetables on rice, stuffed baked squash, stuffed peppers, stuffed baked potatoes, fajitas, they're usually loaded with vitamin-rich peppers, pancakes topped with a fresh fruit medley, fruit compote, fruit smoothie. One client, Sally, was averse to fruit, though she didn't know why, she just had trouble eating it. But one day she found she was having no difficulties whatsoever. What had changed? Two things. First, she was rid of her diet mentality, and second, she began eating fruit in a non-diet manner. All of her past diets had prescribed eating a Spartan single fruit for a snack or with a meal, such as a plum, an apple, and so forth. When she tried fruit salad of all sorts, her interest in fruit was renewed. Frankly, we've never seen anyone get into trouble eating fresh fruits and vegetables, unless that's all they eat. In fact, emerging research results also show this to be true. John Potter, a physician and researcher out of the University of Minnesota, has been studying a group of people who were told to eat up to 8 servings a day of fruits and vegetables. His preliminary data suggests that people eating more fruits and vegetables actually like it and feel better on it. Eat enough fish. There is a bounty of research that shows a multitude of benefits from eating seafood, from improved mood to lower risk of chronic diseases. This health benefit prompted the 2010 U.S. Dietary Guidelines to include a recommendation for eating fish. Drink enough fluids, primarily water rather than sugary beverages. Water actually doubles as both a beverage and a nutrient. Water is essential for living. We can only survive a few days without it. We included it because it often gets overlooked. The need for getting plenty of fluids is no secret, but many of our clients wind up short in this department. The traditional 8 8-ounce cups of fluid a day is the same as drinking a half gallon. That's the size of your typical milk carton. Other fluids, such as milk and tea, can help meet your water quotient. Even solid foods like fruit provide water. The issue of processed foods. Generally, the less a food is processed, the more nutrients are retained, and less sodium and sugar are added. If possible, choose the following types of foods to eat more often. Nutrient-dense foods. These foods naturally provide more nutrients per bite. These include whole grains, beans, fish, avocado, nuts, and calcium-rich foods such as milk, cheese, yogurt, and calcium-fortified soy milk. Protein-rich foods. Eat a variety of these foods. They include beans, seafood, chicken, turkey, nuts, and lean meats, eggs, and dairy. In addition to its role in building and maintaining muscles and hormones, protein helps provide a feeling of fullness. Quality fats. Fat is also a nutrient required by the body. Notably, when the essentiality of fats was first discovered, they were called vitamin F. Too bad this nomenclature didn't stick. If it had, it would help remind people that we do need some fat in our diet. We need fat in our diet to help absorb fat-soluble nutrients such as vitamin A and vitamin E. The brain is made up of mostly fat and functions best with omega-3 fats, which are found in seafood, fish oil, algae, and seaweed. Other quality fats include olive oil, avocado, nuts, seeds, flaxseed oil, and canola oil. And for satisfaction purposes, fat is the molecule that gives flavor to foods and promotes satiety. Whole foods. These are the unprocessed foods which are high in fiber and include, for example, brown rice, oatmeal, millet, beans, quinoa, fresh fruits and vegetables. The fat-free trap. The low-fat message has gone to extreme levels for many chronic dieters and has created the fat-free trap. Because fat has become the national enemy, it has spawned a profitable cottage industry of fat-free foods, from fat-free cheese to fat-free potato chips and ice cream. While this may seem advantageous to the American diet, we've seen problems, especially for chronic dieters. One of the most common problems we see is the idea that it doesn't count. I can eat as much as I want. The problem with this thinking is that it can actually lead to overeating. Instead of responding to satiety levels, it often becomes an eating affair of, I'm going to eat it all. When inner satiety cues are bypassed, it perpetuates further dissonance from your body. In addition, fat-free does not mean calorie-free. Ironically, many of our clients discover that if they were to have the real version of a food, they'd end up eating much less because it's more satisfying and they would remain in touch with satiety cues. Eating fat-free foods is not the epitome of healthy eating. Sugar is naturally fat-free, yet one would hardly want to base a diet on sugar for health. Yet that's what many people are doing when they are building diets based primarily on processed, fat-free foods. Many of the fat-free products are high in sugar, especially the desserts, and low in whole grains. For example, Rice Krispies cereal proclaims on its label that it's always been fat-free. But it's also always been low in fiber. If your prime mission in eating is selecting processed, fat-free foods, you could easily end up with a nutritionally weak diet. There's nothing wrong with eating fat-free foods as an adjunct to a healthy diet. But you cannot assume that just because you've been eating 100% fat-free foods, your diet is healthy. What's on your plate? We've talked about how important it is to make peace with food. There's a useful tool that extends this principle to nutrition for meals. Visualize your plate as a lopsided peace sign, mainly filled with carbohydrate-rich foods, grains, fruits, and vegetables. This tool serves two purposes. First, it gives you an easy-to-remember guide for healthy eating and helps to serve as a reminder to keep the peace with food. Remember, this is just a guide, not a rigid edict. There are days when your intuitive signal sends you to a different balance of foods. It's important to look at the big picture rather than judging your overall nutrition by one particular day. So where's the chocolate group? As we have said, we're not going to pull a fast one. There are no forbidden foods because deprivation doesn't work. All of the above guidelines are intended as a balance over time, which means even if you eat a candy bar, it will eventually average out. When you have let go of the diet mentality and have made peace with food, you will discover that you sometimes have a desire for food that has no nutritionally redemptive powers. We call this food play food. We prefer this term to one of the most commonly used terms to describe what's considered unhealthy foods, junk food. The term junk food implies that there is no intrinsic value in this food. In fact, that it probably should be thrown in the garbage can. But we feel that this thinking is unwarranted. There are times when a piece of red velvet cake or a stick of licorice is just the food that will satisfy your taste buds. And eating these types of foods doesn't mean you are an unhealthy eater. Here's a favorite story I like to tell that illustrates this point. One day when my son was a teenager, he asked me, Mom, what happens to people who don't eat as healthily as you do? His question sparked a sense of pride in me that as a nutritionist, I had taught him the virtues of healthy eating. My response to him included some lofty comments about how people who didn't pay much attention to nutrition probably had a higher incidence of heart disease, diabetes, cancer, and so forth. But before I could get the words fully out of my mouth, he pointed to me with his best adolescent gotcha finger and said, "But sometimes I see you eating French fries and other junk foods." I had to stop and laugh for a moment and then said, "You're right, honey. Much of what I eat considers my health, and sometimes I eat things just for pleasure." I explained that for true satisfaction in my eating, those foods that he called junk can be part of a balanced diet. From that point on, the term junk food has been replaced with play food for its role in the world of eating satisfaction. But how can eating play foods be healthy? This is where you pull together all the intuitive eating skills, which means, in a nutshell, listening to your body. This is key. For example, if you were to eat chocolate all day long, there's a very good chance that by the end of the day you would experience the following physical feelings: nauseous, heaviness, dullness, and so forth. The question to you is, do you want to continue feeling this way? The truth is, if you listen to your body, you will not feel good eating this way. Even kids exposed to gobs of Halloween candy do not want to indulge for long. And when you know that you can truly have the food again, chocolate or whatever else, it doesn't not take too much to satisfy you. One client, Joe, was extremely fond of chocolate. He had truly made peace with food and was also at the stage of honoring his health. He was grocery shopping and discovered a new triple chocolate ice cream dessert, which was very rich. He chose not to buy it, not because it was loaded with fat, but because he did not want to experience what he calls headache food. He did not feel deprived. He knew he could have chocolate whenever he wished, and instead bought a small bag of M&Ms and was satisfied. Making informed food choices. Clients often ask us if there is any value in knowing the nutrient content of food. The answer to this question can be tricky. If you have any remnant of diet mentality lingering in your mind, looking at a food label might trigger some of your old diet thoughts. If, on the other hand, your food choices are based on hunger and deriving satisfaction from your meal, then having a general sense of the nutrient content of foods, such as fiber, fat, and sodium, can help guide your eating decisions. For example, if you know that including high-fiber foods in your meals will be beneficial to the functioning of your gastrointestinal tract, and you notice that one type of whole wheat bread is higher in fiber than another, then by all means choose the higher-fiber product. Using nutrition information in this manner helps to honor both your palate and your health. Or suppose you discover for the first time that a particular canned soup is very high in sodium, and you're concerned that it might have an adverse effect on your blood pressure. You may feel that you could take or leave the soup because you don't enjoy it that much and wouldn't feel deprived by choosing a lower sodium soup. You might also decide that if you are going to eat something high in sodium, you'd rather have pizza. Or perhaps you discover that a beverage you drink contains a high amount of sugar and you would equally enjoy mineral water. Then by all means opt for the mineral water. There may come a time in your journey back to your intuitive eater when eating with regard to nutritional quality becomes a priority for you. The key to knowing if you're ready for that decision is based on the following. In making your food choices, are you considering the sensual qualities of the food, while at the same time honoring how you will physically feel when you eat this food? Do you have a medical condition that will be helped by paying attention to nutrition? Does thinking about nutrition feel neutral to you, rather than stirring up any old diet thoughts? Are you able to choose a food that may not have a high nutritional value, but will simply give you pleasure, without any old guilt feelings? If you can answer yes to these questions, then making choices based on health and nutrition will not betray your ability to be an intuitive eater. How to keep the pleasure in healthy eating. If we are to change our eating attitudes to enlightened hedonism, we need to balance information with the pleasure of eating. The information part comes from two sources, listening to your body and the nutrition guidelines we shared in this chapter. Listening to your body means not only staying in touch with satiety levels, but also assessing the following questions. Do I really like the taste of these foods, or am I being a diet health martyr? How does eating this food or type of meal make my body feel? Do I like this feeling? How do I feel when eating consistently in this manner? Do I like this feeling? Would I choose to feel this way again? Am I experiencing differences in my energy level? If eating healthfully is a pleasurable experience and it makes you feel better, you are more likely to continue honoring your health with your food choices. The key, however, is not to turn the idea of healthy eating into an all-or-none prospect based on deprivation. Deprivation does not work in the long run. It's hard to enjoy eating a meal when the people around you are engaged in dieting talk, fat talk, or body bashing. To keep the pleasure in eating, consider your intuitive eating bill of rights. 1. You have the right to savor your meal without cajoling or judgment, and without discussion of calories eaten or the amount of exercise needed to burn off said calories. 2. You have the right to enjoy second servings without apology. 3. You have the right to honor your fullness, even if that means saying no thank you, without explanation, to dessert or a second helping of food. 4. You have the right to stick to your original answer of no, even if you are asked multiple times. Just calmly and politely repeat, no, thank you, really. 5. It is not your responsibility to make someone happy by overeating, even if it took hours to prepare a specialty dish. 6. You have the right to eat pumpkin pie for breakfast or cereal for dinner, regardless of judgmental comments or rolled eyes. Remember, no one, except for you, knows how you feel, both emotionally and physically. Only you can be the expert of your body. This requires inner attunement rather than the external, well-meaning suggestions from family. Don't let yourself be put on a food pedestal. At first, our clients think we must be perfect in our eating habits. After all, we are dietitians. We are not food and nutrition goddesses and do not want to be placed on a pedestal. Some of the best information we've passed on to our patients is not about how nutritiously we eat, but rather that we ate a whole piece of tiramisu and enjoyed each bite. Or how we got stuck with our food down, so to speak, and gobbled the nearest candy bar. And in spite of these times, we balance out our nutrition. We still honor our health and our taste buds and our humanness. Many of our clients have been elevated to a place of specialness among their friends, colleagues, and family members because they appear to eat so well. She is the health-conscious one. In the beginning, it's fun to garner the extra attention because they have attached a value to this identity. After a while, however, most of our clients no longer want this notoriety. It adds more pressure. When you are on this food pedestal, it can intensify feelings of deprivation. It often means sneaking around to eat, which doesn't feel good, or creates fears of getting caught. My goodness, to get caught cheating on your diet, horrors! I'll never forget attending a dinner hosted by a professional group at an incredible French restaurant. I was a stranger, seated among 20 people at the same table. I was a guest of one of the members. As the meal was winding down, the server presented us with a bounty of beautiful desserts. When the last dessert was described, someone asked, "Let's see what the nutritionist thinks. Which one of these desserts is the healthiest to choose?" This was a food pedestal moment. As I opened my mouth to speak, all heads turned toward me and I replied, "What's more important is whatever dessert is the most satisfying." There was a very loud and collective sigh of relief. Our clients usually feel relieved when they voluntarily dethrone themselves as the food fitness czars. What this means is they are no longer closet eaters. They no longer put on a false food face. If they feel like ordering dessert with a meal, they will. It's their opportunity to show how appearing to be a perfect eater does not equate to the value of optimal health and fitness. Remember, balance is the key. Chapter 15, Raising an Intuitive Eater. What works with kids and teens? We are often asked if it is possible to teach children intuitive eating. The answer is, not only is it possible to help children return to the intuitive eaters they were at birth, but it is often easier than with adults. Children are less dubious than adults, and far more open and eager. Let's begin with prevention. When an infant is born, this child is equipped with the innate ability needed to know how to eat. I was fortunate enough recently to visit a friend's daughter, who had just given birth 2 weeks before to her beautiful baby girl. Alexis was just getting comfortable with the overwhelming task of figuring out how to take care of her newborn. Which cry meant that she was sleepy, which one said that there was a diaper that needed changing, and which one let her know that the baby needed to eat. Now, if you have ever observed a hungry baby, you know that her most recognizable cry is the one of hunger. If the child is ignored when she's hungry, she'll scream and scream until offered the breast or bottle. The hunger signal is acutely available for the majority of babies, and there is a natural instinct to make the need for nourishment known. I was sitting and talking with Alexis when little Lily made the noises that let her mother know that she was hungry. To sit and watch this beautiful connection between mother and child was a true gift. Lily nursed on one breast and then the other, and when she was full, she turned her precious head away and fell asleep. Alexis was in awe of how intuitive her infant's feeding experience was. If there is attunement to the wide array of obvious and nuanced messages that the child offers, the child will grow up with a sense of self-confidence that his needs are appropriate and will be consistently met. When the child is hungry and is quickly fed, many important messages will be conveyed. The first message is that hunger is a natural, normal, and correct sensation. As time goes on, the feeling of hunger will be coupled with the drive to find food. An attuned response to the child's hunger will elicit a sense of safety, eliminating any fear of deprivation. If, instead, this primary need of the child is not met at the appropriate times, the child will begin to fear that there won't be enough food. In response, this child is in danger of muting hunger signals, rather than trusting that the hunger signal is a reliable message throughout life. Imagine an infant who was put on a feeding schedule, something that was a common recommendation from generations past. The parent was advised to place the baby on a schedule of eating, ranging from every 2 to 3 hours to every 3 to 4 hours. Many parents responded positively to this recommendation, as regulating the feeding schedule would allow them to plan the whole day in advance. Of course, most parents did not adopt this method out of selfish needs. They were counseled that a regular feeding schedule would be best for the child. Unfortunately, this is not usually the case, as this method has the potential to create a number of problems. If the child got hungry and cried half an hour before the scheduled time, the parent was prompted to wait to feed her. If, on the other hand, the child wasn't yet hungry at this time, she might be coaxed to eat anyway. Since hunger and fullness signals were not consistently being reinforced, the hungry, screaming baby, or the not yet hungry baby, was on his way to mistrusting these powerful messages. For the hungry infant, the potential fear of future deprivation can take root. For the infant who was encouraged to eat before hunger had sufficiently arrived, confusion and resistance to eating can emerge. For a child who is fed on schedule rather than on demand, moving on to the toddler years can initiate a disordered relationship with food. If an abundance of food becomes available to a child who had experienced a feeling of deprivation in infancy, the child might be prone to develop a natural tendency to overeat. When the next meal is offered, one of two possibilities might occur. The child is likely to be too full and refuse to eat, or might go beyond this fullness signal and take in even more food, storing up for the next potential famine. For the child who had been cajoled to eat as an infant, the freedom to eat more independently as a toddler can also present two possibilities. He might continue to eat when he's not yet hungry, or he might exert his independence by refusing to eat. Fortunately, feeding schedules are rarely recommended today, and conscientious caregivers tend to respond regularly to the child's hunger signals. But what about fullness signals? Have you ever tried to continue to feed an infant after she turns her head away from the breast or bottle because you're afraid that she hasn't had enough nutrition or that she's not growing quickly enough? When that child's tummy is full, she will naturally balk at being force-fed. We have seen, with horror, toddlers who were regularly persuaded to eat more than they needed throughout their first couple of years. Eventually, they either gained far more weight than was healthy or ended up getting into food fights and refused to eat much at all. For example, the mother of a very young client was actually referred to Child Protective Services by the psychiatrist involved in the treatment. This mother had had a sister who died in a starved state from anorexia nervosa. Because of this, she associated being underweight with death and became terrified that her child would be underweight. As a result, she stuffed her little boy with enormous amounts of food. This was seen as emotional child abuse. The most fundamental step in ensuring that a child retains all of his innate ability around hunger and fullness is trust. Ellen Satter, in her groundbreaking book, Child of Mine, Feeding with Love and Common Sense, aptly states that it's the parent's job to provide the food, and the child's job to eat as much or as little as he needs. In infancy, it's not often that a parent deviates from this give and take, but as children move out of the milk-only phase, parents have a more difficult time staying tuned in to the child's eating signals. Parents believe that there are so many legitimate reasons for them to try to take control of the child's eating. In this era of the epidemic of childhood obesity, the fear of a child gaining too much weight often leads well-meaning pediatricians to give parents the advice to monitor what and how much a child is eating. The opposite situation can also be present if there is a fear that the child is not gaining enough weight. In addition, many parents who want to help their children be as healthy as they can allow them to eat only nutritionally dense foods and restrict them from play food. Although this attempt to control the amount and type of food children are eating is often born from good intentions, it also brings the potential for the child's mistrust of his signals. Not only are his hunger and fullness signals missed, but also his innate understanding of his food preferences and how his body feels after eating different amounts and types of foods. Instead of listening to and respecting her own physical reactions to the eating experience, the child reacts to the parent's external message rather than her own internal knowledge. This reaction can run the gamut of being the good little girl and doing everything that mommy wants, to acting out as the rebellious child who refuses to eat most everything. Family experiences. We've worked with many parents and children whose stories have spoken of some of the difficulties that arise in knowing how to handle the feeding arena with children. In future sections of this chapter, you will read about our tips and guidelines for protecting your child's inborn intuitive signals and for healing some of the problems that may have already arisen. Some families are able to transcend these difficulties by adopting an intuitive eating approach, and some have a harder time making this shift. This process of prevention and healing will be illustrated by vignettes of some real-life clients. As you've been reading so far, you may have been thinking, how can I trust that my child will be an intuitive eater? How can I allow my child to make these decisions on her own? All she'll want to eat is candy. Before learning how to heal existing problems, let's first explore the stories of some children who have been able to grow up with all of their intuitive eating signals intact. Fortunately, we have the great honor to hear about many children who have been born to and raised by parents who have sought our help to return to their own intuitive eating. As a result, these parents are committed to raising their children with the same philosophy. And how incredible it is to watch the fruit of their labors. Jeannie and Jimmy. Jeannie's been a client for many years. She now has a 2.5-year-old son who continues to amaze her with how intuitive his eating is. Jimmy's favorite play food is chocolate-covered blueberries. At every meal, his mom puts a bowl of these blueberries on the table, along with all of the other foods she has prepared. She mentioned that sometimes all that Jimmy eats are the blueberries. Sometimes he eats a few of them, and at other times he eats all of his other food and eats none of the blueberries. Sometimes he just likes to take the blueberries out of the bowl and then put them back. His mom has no agenda about Jimmy's eating. She sees that over a week's time he eats a well-balanced array of foods, is growing beautifully, and is full of health and energy. Jeannie's sister has a different approach for her children. Her daughter had loved M&Ms since she first saw them as a small toddler. This little one's mother was so afraid that she would eat too many that she began to ration them out whenever they were around. This little girl has become obsessed with M&Ms and cannot get enough of them. Her cousin Jimmy, on the other hand, occasionally asks for a lollipop or two. Sometimes he wants to hold one in each hand or open several of them. He takes one lick and is more fascinated with the wrapping than he is with the actual candy. Andrea and Allie. Andrea was referred for counseling by her pediatrician when her baby, Allie, was 7 months old. Andrea had told her doctor that she had no idea how to feed her child, having suffered with anorexia, bulimia, and compulsive overeating throughout her teens and 20s. Allie was more than ready to eat solid food, but Andrea not only didn't know how to proceed, she was terrified to create an eating disorder in her own child. She arrived in the office on that first session and offered a big hug in hope and gratitude and said, "Please teach me how to feed my daughter." In those first few months of counseling, Andrea was not only taught how to introduce vegetables and fruits and grains and meats, etc., to Allie, but she was also introduced to intuitive eating to help heal her own disordered eating. Through Allie's toddler years, she had the advantage of being offered every possible nutritious food that her mother would prepare and would sit at the table with her parents while eating. She wasn't introduced to play food in her home as a tiny child, but when she was at others' homes, no restriction was put on her exploration of foods that were offered. Carrots and ice cream and spinach and candy were all treated equally. Andrea made no comments and gave no judgmental glances at Allie's choices. As a result of this freedom, Allie, at 7 years old, has only a moderate interest in play food and a true desire for a wide range of more nutritious food. A couple of years ago, she woke up one morning and asked Andrea for tofu and hearts of palm for breakfast. When it was her turn to bring a snack to nursery school, she wanted to bring bok choy. At a friend's house, where all of the visiting children were eating ice cream, she asked for carrots. When asked at school to draw a picture of her favorite food, Allie drew Brussels sprouts. But don't get the wrong impression. Allie also loves candy and cookies. She simply has no need to fill up on these foods, because they're never restricted and never judged. Allie is also a very active little girl and loves her dance classes with a passion. There are no food fights between her and her parents. Instead, there is a healthy relationship with food, which is acutely attuned to her hunger, fullness, and food preferences. It was recently Allie's 7th birthday. She decided that she wanted to have crab legs at her birthday dinner and chose sides of carrots and potatoes. When she had had enough of her dinner, the server asked what she wanted for dessert, and she told him she was full and didn't feel like dessert. He was stunned and kept pressing her about it being her birthday and needing to celebrate with cake. Allie politely explained, "I'm very full and don't want more to eat, but you can sing me happy birthday." Her mother is regularly taken by Allie's comments about how poorly other children eat. She just doesn't understand why they're stuck on one type of food or are begging for dessert. The only unfortunate experience that Andrea can report involves a dance teacher who saw Allie eating little cubes of tofu. The teacher said something like, "Ick, I don't like tofu." As this teacher was deeply admired by Allie, it's not surprising that Allie has refused tofu since having had this experience. What power we adults have on these impressionable children. Role modeling. The tofu experience, just described, brings up an extremely important aspect of the relationship between a child's eating and the eating of adults who influence the child. Parents tend to serve as the primary role models in the realm of eating. There is great power in setting an example of eating when hungry, stopping when full, and eating a large variety of foods. This is a case of do what I do rather than do what I say. The more talk there is about food, whether it's positive encouragement to try foods or negative strivings to reduce a child's quantity of food, the more the opportunity for a child's resistance or rebellion toward the authority figure. The less talk and the more role modeling, the more likely it is that the child will try new foods, find vegetables interesting, and have more balance in the entire eating experience. Jill and Billy. Jill is a client who first sought nutrition counseling after a lifetime of eating disordered behavior and body image problems. Her mother was always on a diet throughout Jill's childhood, and Jill began attempting to control her weight in her late teens through diets and restrictive eating. Her restrictive eating ultimately led to a diagnosis of anorexia nervosa and a mind that could think of nothing else but food and body. At the time she sought counseling, she was married and thinking about having children. She was very worried that if she didn't heal her own problems, she would eventually transmit them to her future children. She was finally ready to make some changes. Jill worked very hard to let go of diet thinking and to start feeding herself according to her body's hunger and fullness signals. She eventually became pregnant, and to this day she credits her improved eating for her ability to become pregnant. She also credits her intuitive eating work for the profound effect it has had on the raising of her first son, and later her second son. She recently told a story that exemplified this. Her oldest son, Billy, who is 4, was sitting at dinner with the family. He turned to his father and said, "Daddy, you need to eat your vegetables. They're good for you." Jill has cooked and served her children a wide range of nutritious foods since each was able to eat solid food. She also keeps play food in the house, attempting to buy foods that offer some nutritional value. Her children love Fig Newtons, graham crackers, dark chocolate almonds, and ice cream. When they're at other children's homes, they are never restricted from any foods that they may find there. Jill has also never commented on how much or how little food the children eat, or classified foods as good foods or bad foods. Above all, she has never told Billy that vegetables are healthy and that he should eat them. She has no idea how he got the thought to tell his father to eat his vegetables and that they're healthy. Jill is raising her boys with the trust that they will get a sufficient variety of food and nutrients if they are allowed to make their own decisions about what they eat and how much. One evening, Billy was eating ice cream and said he was full after having finished half of it. He asked his mom to put the other half in the freezer and save it. The next morning, when Jill asked Billy what he would like to have for breakfast, he said that he'd like to eat ice cream and grapes for breakfast. And that's what he ate.